My name is Matt Katz. I'm in for Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Earlier this year, the Norwegian Nobel Committee made an unexpected announcement. They awarded the Nobel Peace Prize to two journalists. And when Dmitry Muratov and Maria Ressa accepted the award in Oslo a couple of weeks ago, they would become the first journalists to be peace laureates in 80 years. Muratov co-founded Novaya Gazeta, an independent news outlet that pushes to hold Russian President Vladimir Putin accountable. During Putin's tenure, six journalists at the newspaper have been killed. And in the Philippines, Ressa, co-founder of online news publication Rappler, was arrested and eventually found guilty under a controversial anti-cybercrime law after being accused of publishing a false news story about a businessman. It wasn't lost on advocates that she was an outspoken critic of Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte.
For me, it's about two things: abuse of power and weaponization of the law. This isn't just about me, and it's not just about Rappler.
Ressa is right. Around the world, press freedom is being challenged at unprecedented levels. A new report by the Committee to Protect Journalists found that a record 293 journalists have been jailed across the world in the last year alone. 24 additional journalists have been killed because of their coverage, while 18 more died in suspicious circumstances. Authoritarian governments in Asia, Africa, and Europe buck due process as they continue to detain journalists in order to protect their power. Look at Myanmar, which had zero journalists in jail this time last year. All it took was a coup earlier in the year, and now there are 26 journalists in custody. And in China, which holds the highest number of jailed journalists in the world at 50, it's not just journalists that are offending the regime there. China arrested 11 non-journalists this past year just for sending materials to reporters. There is a human toll here that should not be neglected. Back in October, The Takeaway spoke with Washington Post journalist Jason Rezaian about journalism being under attack after he himself was held captive in Iran for 18 months.
I believe in the importance of press freedom and really the need to protect it as a guiding principle of democracy and one that is constantly under threat. My wife actually now works at the Committee to Protect Journalists. This is something that we care deeply about. And I've also told a lot of stories of other people who've been taken hostage by governments especially.
So with us is the editorial director at the Committee to Protect Journalists, Arlene Getz, and Ohumai Amaize, an exiled Nigerian journalist now living in the U.S. I started by asking Arlene about whether there is a prevailing phenomenon that led to many of these arrests around the world.
What we're seeing is that every year these numbers are creeping up. This is the sixth year in a row that we've had more than 250 journalists arrested in jail as of December the 1st, which is when our census is finalized. And it's a disturbing pattern of sort of growing authoritarianism, lack of respect for due process, a sense of impunity around the world. But it's a very disturbing trend in a world which is currently preoccupied by COVID and so many other issues as well.
And I just want to like expand out a little bit to explain to people the importance of this. You know, do you view journalists as sort of a canary in the coal mine when it comes to limiting freedoms across the board?
Absolutely. And that's a very good point. This is not something that's just about journalists. We document journalists because we are the Committee to Protect Journalists and our focus is on press freedom. But every time a journalist is silenced, there's less information that's getting out to the public. And I'm not just talking about politics and other issues here. Think, for example, about COVID. You know, China has a situation where they've imprisoned a woman called Zhan Zhang, who has been there for over a year. She was trying to tell people what was happening with COVID. There are matters of enormous public interest and public importance that do not get publicized when journalists are jailed like this.
Oh, my, you escaped Nigeria. You were granted asylum here in the U.S., and that's all because you were targeted by your country's government for your news coverage. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened?
Yeah, thank you very much. Let me begin by providing a context for the work I did as a TV producer and anchor in Nigeria. In August 2018, when my program launched on Africa Independent Television, which is Nigeria's first and largest privately owned TV network, roughly around 50% of the country's population had access to the internet, with just around 15% active on social media. So majority of Nigerians still rely on traditional media platforms such as radio and television for access to news and information. It was within this context that Kakaki Social was created. That was the TV program that I anchored. It soon became a means through which most Nigerians who didn't have access to the internet or social media connected with conversations by Nigerians on social media platforms. Essentially, it became a bridge between those two audiences. The show focused on conversations around key issues of public interest, from human rights abuses to corruption in government. And the Nigerian government didn't like that. Barely 3 months after the show launched, I started receiving attacks on social media from pro-government handles. Basically, they were trying to discredit the work that I was doing, which had become very impactful. This was a program that kept millions of Nigerians glued to their TV sets on Mondays to Fridays by 8 a.m. But my situation didn't end with the attacks on social media. Strange things started happening. Several times I noticed my car was being followed. I couldn't tell who these people were. I also started receiving physical threats by officials of the Muhammadu Buhari administration in Nigeria on several occasions. Once it's time for my program to go live, my TV network would suddenly experience a blackout. Once the time slot for my program had elapsed, the signals would return. But I became more alarmed when an insider in the Muhammadu Buhari regime, who loved the work that I was doing, showed me WhatsApp conversations in which officials of the regime were plotting to get me arrested and to shut down the program. One of the specific words used in those conversations was slander. They said I was slandering the president, which was just nonsense. Less than a week after this development, the Nigerian government shut down the TV network. Although it was reopened after a court order, agents of the State Security Service, which operates as Nigeria's secret police, were stationed within the premises of the network. Shortly after, I received a tip that I was going to be framed for treason if I returned on air to continue with the program. That was when I knew I wasn't really safe in Nigeria anymore and I had to leave the country. Wow. So this is the background to my experience. And Aline, thank you so much. CPJ actually played a role in helping me to get legal representation for my asylum case here in the US. I actually got pro bono legal representation thanks to the CPJ who helped me with that.
Omai, were you reporting on anything specifically about the president that was considered offensive?
Oh, several things about the president. Things about the president, his performance in government, how Nigerians were assessing his performance. Comments from Nigerians every day talking about issues in his government. And the presidency considered some of those things too embarrassing for Nigerians to see on the big screen of broadcast television.
Right. Arlene, are you seeing new laws being enacted in different countries that make it easier for governments to jail journalists?
Yes, absolutely. We're seeing new laws, especially on the sort of digital and cyber front. But we're also seeing a lot of other methods that are being used to intimidate journalists. Ohima's case is one example. We, as I said, our cutoff point for us, prison census was December 1st. There have been a number of arrests of journalists since then, particularly Ethiopia. The situation is deteriorating very quickly in Ethiopia. We've also seen the sentencing of two journalists in Egypt. Egypt is the third worst jailer of journalists, according to our census. And just this week, we had two journalists who were sentenced to 4 and 5 years. But they've spent years in jail already. You know, there are people who are released from jail and then they ending up having to spend every night in a police station because one of the conditions of their release is they go and report to the police every day and then the police officer on duty can tell them to stay where they are. So we're seeing just a welter of laws and that are being used to harass and intimidate journalists. And the number of people in jail is just one part of that story.
Omai, are other Nigerian journalists back home also at risk of being jailed or silenced?
Absolutely. Just a couple of weeks after I fled the country, other journalists were targeted. Some were arrested and detained. We had the case of a journalist, Agba Jalingo, who was arrested and detained for months without trial. We had the case of a recent case of Luka Biniat in Kaduna State in Northwest Nigeria, who was arrested for reporting about the violent killings in Kaduna State. So we've had things like that happening. And speaking of laws, there is a particular law, the Nigeria Cybercrime Act, which is being used currently to target journalists and activists. There is a particular offense described as cyber stalking, which essentially means you can't say certain things on the internet or online about powerful people in government. So it's one new law that the Nigerian government has been using to target journalists for saying things they don't like.
Oh my, have you encountered any smear campaigns or intimidation tactics since you've been exiled, since you came to the U.S.?
Oh, yes. When the news of my exit from Nigeria broke, the Nigerian government sponsored people to attack my reputation on social media. They said all sorts of nasty things about me. Nobody was after him. He's just running away, all sort of things, basically to discredit my person and my reputation. But I'm used to all of that. It comes with the territory.
Arlene, you started to mention some of the countries, some of the world's biggest defenders of press freedom. What can you tell me about China? What sort of work are Chinese journalists doing that is offending the regime there? I guess they're on the top of this list, right?
Right. Yes. China is the world's biggest jailer of journalists. And this is, I believe, the third year in a row that it has been that. The past year, what we did see was Hong Kong being included for the first time because of the arrest of eight journalists in Hong Kong. But basically, in China, what we're seeing is, you know, the crushing of dissenting voices. There are a lot of Uyghur journalists who are still in prison, some of them serving life sentences. And again, it's part of the general clampdown that we are seeing, which is especially concerning given that, you know, we're about to see China host the Winter Olympics.
Right.
And yes, and journalists are preparing to go there, and we don't hold out very high hopes that they'll be able to do much in the way of reporting. I should also mention that the Chinese government are clamping down on people, even with fairly tangential relationship to journalism. There were, I think, 10 people arrested because the Chinese government said they'd contributed to the Epoch Times. The Epoch Times editors say they're not journalists. You know, I don't know if they'd contributed material or not, but you know, so we're seeing a lot of this again. Arrests being one part of the picture and of a broader clampdown on freedom of expression on independent media.
Arlene, while we're seeing a spike in journalists jailed across the world, your report found that no journalists were jailed in North America by the time that you did this report. Does that mean those of us practicing journalism in this corner of the world are safe?
Well, safer than in a lot of other countries, certainly, but no, not completely safe. I mean, just before the report was published, Canada held two journalists for, I think it was 3 nights in custody for covering protests against a pipeline. They were released ahead of the census, so we didn't count them. But also in the US itself, we were seeing a lot of arrests of journalists. You know, not as many as during the Trump years, but still the number of arrests were 57. It's more than 140 journalists who have been assaulted in the U.S. in 2021. The actual number, according to the U.S. Freedom Tracker, is 142. Most of that was at protests. So we're talking about a range of protests. A lot of the protests, of course, were anti well, COVID related. And there's still this deep mistrust of the media. So no, not the press picture in the US is definitely not what we would like it to be.
Oh, Mike, can you talk to us about the difference in the media landscape between Nigeria and then the US, since now you're here in this country and are able to observe how freedom of the press is, you know, operates or doesn't, as the case may be?
Well, in terms of the landscape, professionally, Nigerian journalists and American journalists do the same thing. But in terms of the environment, it's definitely not the same. At least no American journalist would be afraid that they would be jailed or arrested and detained indefinitely for something they have published about a powerful person. And that is what you see increasingly happening in a place like Nigeria. In October 2019, Amnesty International launched a report that highlighted attacks on the press in Nigeria since 2015. And according to that report, at least 19 journalists and media practitioners were attacked in Nigeria between January and September 2019. It's the highest since 2015. And also in Nigeria, what we have seen is an expansion of this repression from the federal government to even subnational governments, which wasn't usually the case. So you have state governors also becoming very brutal in the way they respond to the things that journalists have published about them.
Arlene, some of the world's biggest offenders in terms of press freedom, like Turkey and Saudi Arabia, had lower numbers this year in terms of arrests, but you reported that that's sort of deceiving because they might be employing other methods of shutting down journalism, right?
Exactly. It is deceiving. You know, initially when these numbers were coming in, we were thinking, well, this is some cause for optimism. But my colleague, Sharif Mansour, wrote a piece as part of the prison census reporting that those countries are able to use other methods to silence journalists. In Turkey, for example, you know, there was a major crackdown after the attempted coup, and a lot of mainstream media have since shut down. So that a lot of journalists just aren't out there anymore. The Turkish government has also allowed a number of journalists awaiting trial to await their trial outside of jail. So we're not counting them as imprisoned. So we're seeing that in Saudi Arabia, the last sort of major wave of arrests was in 2019. But the chilling effect of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi and the arrests, that has a massive intimidatory effect. There's also the fact that surveillance is now being used to control journalists. We've read a lot about Pegasus spyware. The Saudi government is one of the governments named as having used the Pegasus spyware. So there are many, many other ways to silence journalists.
Do you think that Western media outlets, let's say just American media outlets, should be playing a role in somehow protecting press freedom around the world and reporting on exiled journalists? Is there a way to do that in a fair way that can shed light on, you know, what's happening?
Absolutely. I think it's very important. Usually, what it appears to us journalists from other parts of the world, especially from Africa, is that the U.S. media doesn't pay as much attention as we think it should to the plight of their colleagues back in Africa.
Right.
And I think things like this kind of conversation we are having now, is very important. At least there are a lot of more people here in the U.S. who would know these kind of stories. Many people don't even know the reality and the context far away in other parts of the world where these things are happening. And thanks to organizations like CPJ who have managed to call attention to these abuses and these repressions suffered by journalists around the world. But like you mentioned, journalists here in the U.S., U.S. newsrooms, U.S. media houses would help the profession generally by putting a spotlight more on stories like mine. There are hundreds of stories like mine from different parts of the world. Some were not as lucky as I was to make it alive out of my kind of situation. We've seen journalists killed, murdered. Some cases are not even known. And so it's a serious issue, because the way I see this is that the attack on one journalist is an attack not just on one person, but the entire profession and everything the profession represents.
Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly. Final question for Ohomai, if I could. What do you envision the future is for press freedom? Are you optimistic, pessimistic?
I am quite pessimistic because the future is very bleak. Governments around the world are increasingly acquiring new technologies and devising new strategies to constrain the space for expression. And that affects journalists definitely. In Nigeria recently, Twitter was banned. In June, Twitter has been banned entirely in Nigeria. And you see more of these kinds of things happening in different parts of the world. And it raises a cause for alarm. But I would say journalists and civic actors around the world need to continue just to fight, to collaborate together to ensure that journalists are safe around the world. But with what is happening right now, I just think it's going to get worse.
Well, thank you for sharing your story, Omai, and I wish you only the safest future going forward. I hope you continue to work in this field of journalism. I've been speaking to Arlene Goetz, editorial director at the Committee to Protect Journalists, and Ohomai Amaize, an exiled Nigerian journalist now living in the U.S. Arlene, Ohomai, thank you so much for coming on The Takeaway.
Thank you, Matt.
In every container of Cascade dishwasher detergent is a small amount of surfactant. This chemical compound is what removes the dried remnant of tomato sauce from your plates without leaving residue or filling your dishwasher up with suds.
It powers through your toughest messes better than the competition. The first time. Now that's clean.
So how is this miracle product made?
Chemistry must be respected.
All right, bear with me for a moment. You start with ethane gas, dilute it with steam, and push it through a 1500-degree furnace until the ethane molecule cracks, creating ethylene. Heat the ethylene, mix with oxygen, pass through a reactor, and once it cools, you wind up with ethylene oxide. Mix that with alcohol and a catalyst, heat and cool once more, and now you've got a product that's helped Cascade producer Procter & Gamble become a leading competitor in the $1.4 billion dishwasher detergent market in the United States.
Yes, science!
But the lesser-known company, BASF, actually manufactures the surfactants at the start of the process. BASF, a German company, makes a variety of chemical products that wind up in all sorts of things. Toothpaste, freezers, sneakers, you name it.
At BASF, we don't make a lot of the products you buy. We make a lot of the products you buy better. BASF.
Missing from my little chemistry lesson? The dangerous cancer-causing byproducts created at each stage of the process. According to a newly published investigation from ProPublica, BASF manufacturing plants throughout the country release air pollutants, exposing some 1.5 million people in the U.S. to elevated cancer risk. For communities living near these chemical plants, some predominantly Black and many working class, environmental protections do little to protect air quality and mitigate their increased risk of cancer. ProPublica reporter Layla Yunus co-wrote this piece, and she joins me now to discuss more and explain all of this to us. Hey there, Layla. Thanks so much for coming on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
How are these plants releasing these dangerous chemicals into the air? I mean, they're making the products inside these facilities. How are the byproducts escaping and affecting the communities nearby?
The byproducts usually escape through large industrial chimneys called stacks, but they can also be released through leaks in the facility. For example, if you have a structure cooking a compound, well, the openings around the structure can be a release point for some of those toxic chemicals.
And the communities near these facilities, can you tell me a little bit about them and generally where they are?
The communities near these facilities can be anywhere from one or several miles away to right across the street. The BASF facility in Whitestone, South Carolina, is actually right across the street from a post office, and there are several houses nearby. The facility in Port Arthur, Texas, however, is a little bit further away from some of the neighborhoods that you see near it.
And how are people in these communities being affected? What did you find?
What we found through the EPA model that we used for our analysis was that these chemical compounds, these toxic chemicals, can disperse miles away from facilities. In some cases, the chemical ethylene oxide, for example, it can disperse very, very far away and elevate cancer risk for people beyond 50 kilometers.
And what is the EPA's role here, Environmental Protection Agency? Is this something that they monitor? How does it work?
The EPA says that it strives to protect the largest amount of Americans possible from a cancer risk above 1 in 1 million. That means if 1 million Americans are exposed to a concentration of a toxic chemical over a presumed lifetime of 70 years, you can expect one person to develop cancer from that exposure. They also say that no American should be exposed above 1 in 10,000. The way that they try to use these thresholds and regulate with them is by requiring facilities to add pollution reduction equipment to their chemical facilities. Mm-hmm. The problem comes in the way that the rules for these equipments are actually written. Our investigation found that in many cases, industry sort of comes in through the back door at the initial stages of this rulemaking process. And the result is more lax pollution reduction equipment rules, which expose more Americans to higher rates of toxic air pollution.
How do these EPA standards here in the U.S. compare to like the standards and practices in Europe?
In Europe, the standards are sort of built on a different system. In the US, regulators sort of ask the question, how much pollution can the environment absorb without people or the environment being harmed? In Germany, what we found is that regulators are really taking care of the problem on the front end, monitoring the amount of pollution escaping the actual chimneys of the plants and doing that regularly. In the US, there isn't a requirement at the federal level for state governments who administer the Clean Air Act to actually regulate and regularly measure what is coming out of facilities. Rather, they usually rely on modeling exercises prior to the actual permit being approved to make those critical decisions about what communities can be exposed to.
Got it. Are the communities near these facilities aware of the toxic dangers that these plants pose to them and to their health? And is there any resistance from the communities against these plants and the way they operate?
Communities in some of the more renowned hotspots, such as Cancer Alley, Louisiana, are painfully aware that what they breathe every day can hurt their health. Other communities are not aware. In Whitestone, South Carolina, near BASF's facility, we were the first to inform residents that the air they're breathing could increase their risk of developing cancer.
What was their reaction?
Surprise. I think we typically expect toxic air pollution, for example, to smell really bad, to sort of make the leaves on the trees sick looking. Ethylene oxide, the chemical being released in Whitestone, South Carolina, is colorless and odorless. And so it can be really difficult to actually have any idea that you're actually being exposed to one of the most toxic chemicals emitted by American industry.
How did you get this information? I mean, this seems like something that the government should be tracking.
It is, in fact. This information came from an analysis of data from an EPA model called RISI, the Risk Screening Environmental Indicators Model. That model has been in development over 30 years, but the EPA has never used it to actually map where toxic hotspots exist around the country. ProPublica did that in a first-of-its-kind analysis, and the result is a map pocketed with hotspots of cancer-causing air pollution. Users can visit our map on our website and can search their address and see where the nearest hotspot to them is located.
Tell me about a woman you interviewed, Holly Walker, who worked near the BASF plant.
So Holly Walker and her husband moved to upstate South Carolina in the 90s. Her husband actually worked for a different chemical plant called Milliken, about 10 miles away from where they lived. Incidentally, they live down the street from BASF's plant in Whitestone. And if you visit her home, it's a beautiful, secluded home on a lake, and it's kind of not the setting that you would expect to be one in which residents are exposed to toxic air pollution. You're in the woods. However, what the EPA model that we used for our analysis indicates is that ethylene oxide exposure down the street can extend far past Holly Walker's home. She had a breast cancer diagnosis in the 90s and a second one in the later part of the 90s. Between those two diagnoses, she worked at the post office right across the street from the BASF plant. Of course, it's impossible for a model to prove a link between a case of cancer and emissions from an industrial facility. However, the model can be used to indicate potential areas of concern, and Whitestone certainly is an area of concern in that EPA model.
So what's the solution here, and where do we go from here? Is this an environment story where a harmful system is too complicated and too entrenched to change? Is there a clear entity responsible and at fault, like the federal regulators or the corporations? What's the path forward?
We focused a lot on the way that German regulators handle toxic air pollution in our story because we wanted to show readers that there is a better and more protective way to regulate these plants. The new Biden EPA has sort of signaled an unprecedented approach to actually tackling toxic air pollution head on, particularly in overburdened communities. They have said that they are even considering revisiting the standard that they consider acceptable, the cancer risk standard that they consider acceptable for residents near plants to be exposed to. At this point, it sort of remains to be seen what the agency is actually going to do to move the needle on toxic air pollution regulation. But we do believe that there is a safer way to operate these facilities. In fact, other countries are already doing it.
Is there anything a responsible consumer can do? I mean, I imagine that you can stop buying pods, Cascade pods for your dishwasher, but then you're buying another pod from another company that might be using a plant in a different community that emits toxic chemicals, right? I mean, what's the responsible path forward for the everyday reader and consumer?
Consumers can make a commitment to buy products that are made with renewable sources. For example, Seventh Generation creates products that come from the palm oil industry. However, that industry has also been linked to bad stuff, human rights violations and deforestation. So ultimately, the solution here is you know, asking our regulators to be better about the way that they regulate sources of toxic air pollution.
Leila, thank you for this work and this journalism and this investigation. And thank you for coming on The Takeaway and talking about it.
Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Leila Yunus, reporter with ProPublica. She worked on the new piece, The Dirty Secret of America's Clean. There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts. Conditions. I'm Matt Katz, in for Melissa Harris-Perry. You're listening to The Takeaway.
How was the trip?
Not bad.
You fly in the friendly skies.
Friendly skies.
Fly in the friendly skies.
Fly in the friendly skies.
You're not just flying, you're flying the friendly skies.
The skies these days, not always so friendly. Since the pandemic started, there's been an uptick in violence on airplanes across the U.S., largely stemming from disputes over masking. According to the Federal Aviation Administration, there have been more than 5,100 reports of unruly passengers as of November 9th. Of those reports, 970 investigations have been initiated, a major increase from 2019, which saw fewer than 150 investigations. For more on the not-so-friendly skies, we spoke with Allison Sider, air travel reporter at the Wall Street Journal. And she started by telling me a bit about why there's been a surge in violence on planes.
Well, it's been kind of a mystery. I mean, since really the start of the year and even a little bit last year, we've just seen a surge of incidents of people behaving really badly on planes. And there's a whole range of behavior from just, you know, yelling and being difficult to you know, people getting violent with flight attendants and with other passengers. And it's not entirely clear why. I mean, we've seen similar bad behavior in all sorts of contexts, like in restaurants, or, you know, just seems like people are kind of at their limit and taking it out on everyone around them.
I mean, are a plurality of the incidents maybe about masking? Does that seems to come up again and again, yeah?
A huge number of the incidents, you know, three quarters or so are related to masks, but some of the most egregious incidents seem completely random and don't necessarily have anything to do with masks. Or often, you know, something we see is an incident that might start as a dispute over masks escalates, you know, well beyond anything having to do with masks. So the masks are definitely appear to be playing a role in driving a lot of this, but they're not the only factor.
Do you see instances in which it's the flight attendant asking somebody to follow the rules and keep their mask on and then they don't and that escalates? Is it other passengers trying to enforce the masking rule? Is it all of the above?
I think all of the above. You know, we have heard of incidents where a flight attendant asks a passenger to put their mask back on, and that sparks a dispute. We've seen incidents where a flight attendant asks someone just to put their tray table up, and that sets someone off. In some cases, it's a generally, you know, more tense environment in the cabin where people are kind of looking around at each other and seeing if other people are wearing masks and asking the flight attendants to intervene if they're not. And it, in some cases, has contributed to just a more generally tense environment.
Have we seen this sort of bad behavior on planes before? I'm thinking of other, you know, tense moments in the nation's consciousness, like after 9/11.
Yeah, you know, there was actually kind of a growing trend of bad behavior on planes leading up to 9/11. And post 9/11, it kind of dropped off. You know, people were on their best behavior. The people were kind of a lot nicer to the people working on planes. You know, there'd been these horrible, tragic events, and, you know, pilots and flight attendants had lost their lives along with other passengers. I think people were very aware of that when they were traveling. And then over the years, you know, people got used to flying again, and it kind of started creeping up. So, you know, even though, you know, the surge that we're seeing right now, like the numbers are huge and unlike anything the FAA has ever really encountered before, flying doesn't always bring out the best in people. So, right. You know, we have seen stuff like this before.
And what are airlines doing about it? Are they responding to this surge in violence, or are they preparing to do something about it? What are they saying?
Airlines have tried a couple of things to get a handle on the situation. They have different approaches about asking people to wear masks, you know, how often the flight attendant should really be reminding people. You know, I think some of them have encouraged flight attendants, like, you know, don't pick a fight. If someone's not wearing a mask, just ask them to put it on. And if they don't, you can write it up later. Some carriers have limited alcohol sales or ended alcohol sales in economy cabins. You know, alcohol has been a huge driver of some of these incidents. You know, flight attendants unions have been really pushing on airports to clamp down on alcohol sales, including to-go alcohol. You know, you're really not allowed to bring alcohol onto the plane. You can order it, you know, if it's being served, but you're not supposed to be bringing drinks onto planes. But, you know, some airports have been selling alcohol to-go, especially during the pandemic, you know, changing service, people carrying plastic cups. So, you know, that's something that I think the FAA has asked airports to tamp down on, and flight attendants unions have pushed back on because so many of these incidents seem to have to do with alcohol.
Right, right. And then the violence that is resulting, is that against passengers or flight attendants, both?
Both, I think. We've seen a couple of really high profile incidents where flight attendants have been injured, you know, by passengers. And we've seen in airports fights breaking out among passengers, amongst each other. But, you know, flight attendants, I think, have been in several cases the targets. You know, they're kind of on the front lines dealing with people if they're out of control or, flying off the handle. So we've seen several incidents over the last couple of months. You know, fortunately, not a lot of these incidents aren't violent, but a few of them are, and it can be pretty bad.
And what is this meant for actual air travel? Like, are there delays, cancellations of flights, or flights getting diverted to other cities? What does this mean for the entirety of the experience?
While there's been a huge surge of these incidents, they are still relatively rare. You know, if you're flying, it's likely it's not going to impact you. But there have been several cases where flights have had to turn back to the gate because someone just refuses to put on a mask and they have to be brought off the plane, or a flight has diverted because a passenger is out of control and it's just not safe to have them, you know, in the air. So a flight has to stop at another airport. Yeah. So we've seen that happen several times. And if you're on one of those flights, it's just really unfortunate because there's nothing you can do about that.
Is this something that the federal government could get involved in? Is there anything that they could do? They make us take off our shoes. I imagine they could put other restrictions in place to try to keep flight attendants and others safe.
Yeah. So the FAA has really been stepping up enforcement of this. You know, they've taken a zero tolerance approach. So there's no more, you know, warnings. If you act out on a plane, you know, you should expect to be punished. The fines are pretty large, you know, tens of thousands of dollars potentially in fines for people acting out. The most egregious cases where someone is violent and there is a real, you know, crime, you know, they're starting to refer those to, you know, DOJ and the FBI for prosecution.
Wow. So what are other passengers supposed to do about this? Like, if the guy next to me is acting idiotically to the flight attendant, are we supposed to step in on behalf of the flight attendant? Are we supposed to mind our own business? Is there any sort of best practice for passengers when you see somebody acting a fool on the plane?
That's a great question. You know, I think the flight attendants do have some training in how to deal with this. You know, they are supposed to be trained in de-escalating situations. They're probably better equipped to deal with it than the average passenger. But we have seen incidents where passengers have helped control other passengers who are out of control. So I think it's probably best to do anything you can not to escalate the situation. You know, I think flight attendants will ask for support if they need it.
Allison Sider, air travel reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Allison, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're less than 2 months away from the 2022 Winter Olympics, where athletes from all over the world will gather to go for the gold. Normally, this is a time for nations to come together, but there will be a few absences.
The United States will not send any official representatives to the Olympics, according to the White House officials today. The U.S. is accusing China of genocide, crimes against humanity, and other human rights abuses.
The United Kingdom, Australia, and Canada are also keeping their representatives at home. We should note that the boycotts only apply to diplomats and not the athletes. In a statement, China's foreign ministry said they basically don't care if the politicians show up or not because it won't affect their nation's success in hosting the Olympics. So things seem a little testy, not in the true spirit of the Olympics, but still, if this boycott isn't really going to change anything, especially for the abuses that do exist on the ground in China, then what's the point? For more on this, I spoke with Jen Kirby, foreign and national security reporter for Vox. I asked Jen to tell me about this boycott and what it means, if anything.
It doesn't mean all that much. This is what they're calling a diplomatic boycott, which basically just means that the United States and a few of its allies, right now, I believe it's the United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia, who are all on board. They're basically not going to be sending any, you know, high-level or government officials. So no delegations from these countries are going to be, you know, attending the opening ceremonies or doing anything over in Beijing. This is an opportunity for the United States and some of its partners to kind of take a stand against Beijing's human rights abuses, which is their justification for the diplomatic boycott, without actually affecting the you know, athletes themselves and the people who are going to be competing at the games.
Sure. Has the U.S. done a diplomatic boycott like this against Olympic Games in the past?
So the last boycott was a real boycott, as far as I know, which was in 1980, which was against Moscow. And that was a full-on boycott, which meant that the United States basically, you know, encouraged or help made the U.S. Olympic Committee not send actual athletes at all. So the U.S. didn't participate in the games, and a few allied countries joined them, not everyone. But this basically didn't really work out so well. The reason for the boycott, of course, was the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. And basically what happened was Moscow got to win a whole bunch of medals. So it was a big win for them. And a bunch of athletes missed out on their one chance to win the Olympic gold. And so it caused a lot of controversy at home without much geopolitical benefit.
Tell us a little bit about the reasons behind this boycott, the human rights violations that are being committed in China right now.
Yeah. So, of course, the big one that is on many activists' mind, of course, is the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, where the Chinese government is waging a mass repression campaign against a Muslim minority. The United States has classified it as a genocide. And so, you know, there's been much reporting done, really incredible reporting done about the human rights atrocities there. People are in internment or, you know, internment camps. There's been reports of forced labor. And so this is sort of the main, atrocities that the United States and its allies are pointing to. But of course, there is, you know, the repression of Tibetans, there the democratic crackdown in Hong Kong. And so there are many other kind of human rights abuses that people are pointing to as a reason why China should not be hosting the Olympic Games this year.
This might be naive, you know, I'm not steeped in the intricacies of diplomatic relations here, but if the motivation is to shed light and attention on, like, the genocide of Uyghurs, wouldn't it have been more effective to send, like, the top human rights official in the Biden administration to the Olympics to decry China's actions to every available TV camera from all over the world to just like use the world's attention as it's turned to China to lay out the case, to lay out the details, as you just told them to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the other kind of counter argument that a lot of, you know, some people might make, which is, you know, and of course the model for that is, you know, the 1936 Olympics in Germany, where, you know, the kind of, you had sort of the example of Jesse Owens, right? We mm-hmm. fight and we compete and we stand up for our values. But I think sort of the argument, I guess, in favor of not sending officials is that China isn't really going to respond to the diplomatic pressure. And so this is more of a way for the Biden administration and some of our allies to kind of split the difference. They will get some news coverage. They'll be able to take a stand, but it won't necessarily kind of change the game because it wasn't going to either way. And so the hope, I guess, is that if we're talking about a boycott, it will kind of bring attention to what is happening. Even though the expectation of sort of China changing its policies is next to nil when it comes to this.
Do some politicians in the States feel that this boycott is weak sauce and not going far enough?
Yeah, I do think that is the case. You know, I haven't, it's probably been changed since, but I know Marco Rubio, for example, has pushed for a more extensive boycott, as have other people. Some athletes in Canada, I saw, were pushing for some athletes to step out. And that's sort of going to be, I think, you know, I think things are a little bit interesting now in that we have the question of COVID, which yeah. is kind of creating this new dynamic. And I think one of the questions will be, will that create an off-ramp for people to sort of kind of do both in a way they hadn't before? But I think there are definitely people pushing for more. And of course, the economics of this, right? It's all well and good for U.S. officials to stay home, but there are, you know, multinational companies who are going to be sponsoring the games. And, you know, a lot of activists are saying that's kind of where it might hurt. And so why aren't these companies or sponsors budging at all when it comes to China?
Sure. And we're not really seeing any corporations or athletes boycotting, are we?
No, I mean, right now it seems to be most companies and athletes are going ahead as with business as usual. I'm sure they're going to be asked quite a lot about it as we get closer and closer to the games. But for now, this is sort of stayed in the political realm, although there are some lawmakers and definitely activists who are pushing for tougher action.
You know, you've described it as symbolic more than substantial, but that doesn't mean that it's consequence-free, right? I mean, there could be an effect in terms of Chinese-American relations?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, I mean, it's certainly China doesn't want the U.S. or anyone else to boycott the games diplomatically. You know, this is, again, we thought COVID was kind of on the wane, but obviously now that we've seen Omicron, the question is a little bit different, but this was going to be, you know, China's big coming out period. They were going to try to maybe do a better job than Tokyo in these pandemic games. This is, you know, a chance for them to showcase Beijing once again on the world stage. And so the idea that, you know, major world powers are saying we're not going to come, they don't like it. And of course, they're going to punch back, you know, rhetorically against it. And I think, you know, as I've written and then talked to experts about this, look, is it going to change anything? No, but this will be another example China points to say, ah, look, you know, the United States, they say they want to, you know, cooperate us on certain issues, but we can't even get them to come to the Olympic Games. And so it might just, in an already tense relationship, just make things a little bit worse.
How has China punched back?
They've kind of gone with their sort of, you know, it's often called wolf warrior diplomacy, right? With their foreign ministers and folks kind of pointing out the ridiculousness of the games. They've basically said, well, it's great that you're not coming. You weren't really invited anyway. And so, which is always like a good one.
Right.
And so they're basically trying to dismiss it and say, this wasn't a big deal. We're not really bothered by it. But I think it definitely does needle them because the Olympics do matter to them and they don't want this conversation happening right now.
You write that this move is at the very least poignant in the wake of what's happened to Chinese tennis star Peng Shuai. Can you talk a little bit about what's happened to her and then the response by the Women's Tennis Association?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that has coincided a little bit with the boycott, which of course was Peng Shuai had made allegations against a high-ranking Chinese Communist Party official for sexual assault, and then basically promptly disappeared. She's since come out. The latest twist, as I understand it, has she said that she never made those allegations. But in sort of defense of their player, the Women's Tennis Association had said that they would not be participating in, you know, tournaments in China. And this is a big deal. And it was a real example of a sports organization standing up to China. We've seen sort of similar kerfuffles with the NBA, for example, and they haven't really taken a stand. And so, I mean, this is enough. It just shows that I think the sports world, beyond sort of the political world, is really trying to grapple with, well, what do we do? You know, China is a big market. They also have, you know, athletes who want to compete on the world stage. How do we handle, you know, how do we exist in this world of China's repression, which is, you know, against groups of people, but also against individuals who speak out against the government? And how do we balance this? And I think, you know, this happening with the Peng Shui incident is raising those questions all over again.
Jen Kirby, foreign and national security reporter for Vox. Jen, really appreciate you joining us today on The Takeaway.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That's all we have for you today. And sadly, it's my last day in the chair for this run of shows. It was my absolute pleasure to be back here at The Takeaway with all of you and this amazing crew of producers while MHP gets some much-deserved time with her family. Melissa is back tomorrow with you for a Christmas Eve special, and then the great Alana Casanova-Burgess, my colleague from WNYC, is with you next week. If you haven't checked out her La Brega podcast, well, let's just say, estás perdiendo, compadres. And of course, call us with your show ideas or suggestions, 877-8-MY-TAKE, that's 877-869-8253, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, in for Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Have a safe and great holiday.